everyone. I'm Dave Norris, Chief Research and Innovation Officer at Louisiana Tech University, and this is Beyond 1894, the Louisiana Tech University podcast. Nanotechnology is a term long identified with scientific research at Louisiana Tech, especially since the creation of the Institute for Micromanufacturing in the 1990s. We also created the nation's first nanoscience bachelor's program about a little over 10 years ago. In 2012, Tech was ranked among the top universities in the nation in the commercialization of micro and nanotechnologies. Nanoscience, from which nanotechnology emerges, is the study of matter in incredibly small scale. For the non-scientists out there, in our English standard measurements, 1 yard is about 3 feet, which equals about 1 meter in the metric system. Nanoscience looks at things in nanometers. A nanometer is about a billionth of a meter. The nanoscale is so tiny that a sheet of paper is about 100,000 nanometers thick. The National Nanotechnology Initiative of the U.S. government started in 2000 and sort of set the pace for nanotech innovation worldwide. That initiative includes numerous federal agencies, such as the National Institutes of Health, the National Science Foundation, Department of Energy, Department of Defense. Among other goals, this initiative is designed to advance a world-class nanotech R&D program and foster innovations in nanotechnology for commercial and public benefit. And nanotechnology is already bringing about a wave of innovation in engineering and technology, and the possibilities for this science seem to be endless. The global market for nanotechnology is about $1 trillion, of which about $800 billion of that is in the United States. And these applications range from impacts on environmental quality, alternative or traditional energy production and storage, detection and treatment of cancer and other diseases, surgical procedures, the way we make and design electronics, the way we develop materials for all wide range of things, and the list goes on and on. So in the studio with me today is Dr. Yuri Lvov, the Tolbert Pipes Eminent Endowed Chair in Micro and Nanosystems at the Institute for Micromanufacturing here at Louisiana Tech. As a chemist, Dr. Lvov has been one of the most influential nanoscience researchers in the world over the past 25 years. He was awarded the Humboldt Scholar Fellowship in the early 90s to conduct his work at the Mainz University Institute of Physical Chemistry in Germany. He was selected for the Humboldt Research Award in 2014, an award reserved for globally renowned scientists and scholars. He's worked at the Max Planck Institute in Germany, the Japanese National Institute of Material Science, and the U.S. Naval Research Laboratory. He's a member of the National Academy of Inventors. And in 2008, Dr. Lvov was selected as the Small Times Magazine Innovator of the Year. Now, Small Times Magazine is a world-leading source of news and information about the commercialization and the commercial applications of micro and nanotechnology. And they selected him as their Innovator of the Year, not just for his scientific research, but for his impact on the commercial development of micro and nanotechnologies. Yuri, thank you for being here this morning and welcome.
Okay, thank you very much that you invited me. And I would be happy to discuss what I am doing my last 30, 40 years. Yes, I am professor on physics, chemistry, and as well, I am professor of nanotechnology.
So you published an important paper in 1997, I believe was the day, where you first laid out this nanoscience concept of layer-by-layer self-assembly. And that paper was recently, if I'm correct, in 2018, selected as one of the best scientific papers of the last 100 years to be published in the Langmuir Journal, which is a journal named after the 1932 Nobel Prize winner in chemistry, Irving Langmuir. Tell us about that paper. Why was it important? How is it affected your career?
Okay, I will answer you in a complicated way. First of all, I have to mention that Langmuir was the first Nobel Prize winner, first American Nobel Prize winner.
First American.
We have special. Yes. It was 1933, 1933, first American Nobel Prize winner. And since then, American scientists so well developed that we're now ahead of all the world in Nobel Prize winners, about 200.
Wow.
Of course, it's very high award. Hardly like we can get it. But we are getting quite good recognition of our research. About this paper, again, I will answer in a complicated way. So in 91, I was a matured scientist. I was 38. I was a young professor in Russia, in Moscow. And I was thinking, life is done. I'm a professor. I will be enjoying life other years. Suddenly, perestroika, country collapsed. All scientists immediately were fired by this idiot. No salary for scientists, no salary for university professors. He told, we don't need them. It's too much. Okay, to this moment, I was quite well known, and I was invited to Mainz University and got special Humboldt Fellowship. It was my first high salary in Western currency. It was about maybe $4,000 per month.
And it might be a good time to leave Russia.
Yes. And then I came. I came to my friend, very famous, maybe number one German physical chemist, Helmut Möbel. We were sitting, I remember, and he told, Yuri, it's a unique chance for you to start something new, absolutely new. Forget everything what you did. You are 38. Try to do something new like graduate student. And then we together invented this method of self-assembly. What means self-assembly? Self-assembly, when you give nature way to create things yourself.
So you don't grab a hold of these things and move them around. You give them the conditions where they can assemble themselves.
And my American, after we invented it, which I will describe in two words, this method, the American New Scientist Journal write, it is like molecular epitaxy for poor people. But, you know, Germany was rich. What's the idea? You remember from high school that positive and negative electricity attracted. Imagine that you have positive and negative
molecules. Opposites attract.
Positive attracted to negative. Mm. And so if you have something, let's say glass, and you dip it in solution, positive, negative, more negative molecule, positive, negative molecule, negative molecule, then you will have layer by layer adsorption, because plus adsorb minus, minus adsorb plus, and you will have precisely one monolayer of negative molecule, another monolayer, and one monolayer, another monolayer. And so you can build from molecules any designer building or designer complex of molecules.
You're right. That did sound complicated. Now, when you're working at the nanoscale, you can't pick things up and grab them with tools. You have to be able to create conditions where they can move around and assemble themselves. So this was revolutionary.
Yes. You rely on self-assembly, exactly as you told. You create conditions when they connect one to another through some special relations.
So this was a brilliant idea and really impacted the field, but I've heard you say more than once, nothing comes from nothing. And what you mean is what?
Nothing comes from nothing. It was a mixture of this. Helmut Möbel was older than me. I was young. And we have based our experience on this work of Langmuir. So it was development of Langmuir work, why it was published in Langmuir Journal. Yes, nothing is coming from nothing.
Even the most original idea has
an origin. So in most cases, and I was quite renowned, and I am quite a renowned scientist, in most cases, our new discoveries were when people meet and exchange ideas.
The open exchange of ideas is critical to the advancement of science.
Yes, but you have to be at the level where high-level people, smart people, are ready to talk to you, to recognize you equal, and fairly exchange with your ideas. Nobody will exchange idea with someone whom he thinks is stupid.
Well, I appreciate you exchanging ideas with me. Now, earlier in this segment, I mentioned some of the potential application areas, broad areas of nanotechnology and the way it can impact the way we live. And the work that you have done has been foundational in helping realize and develop some of the potential of micro and nanotechnologies, and the applications abroad. So you've done work with applications in targeted drug delivery, enhancing, I guess I would say, construction or fabrication materials to make them fire resistant, mold resistant, antimicrobial, even self-healing materials. Strengthening enhancement of recycled fibers for reuse. Smart nanocontainers, let's call them. So tell us about what some of the most interesting applications that you've had in your work or that you see in nanotech.
So we can create very thin organized films. So we can create film where molecules will be placed exactly as you design them. One molecule, second molecule, third molecule, and so on. So first we made smart surfaces which can protect against wetting, which can prevent burning of plastic, for example, coated with these surfaces, which make them biocompatible. Surprisingly, the most grants and the most research money, and you cannot do research without money, brought our technology of encapsulation of drugs. And when people discover drugs, it's only half a way to treat people. Then you have to deliver this drug to body. And many, for example, anti-cancer drugs are very efficient, but not water soluble. So there is no way to deliver it to body through injection, because they probably, for example, soluble in acetone. You cannot inject acetone. And then we suggested, and we had two big grants from NIH. And first, our big grant from NSF. And when big, I mean $1 to $3 million dollars. And it was drug encapsulation in a tiny capsule. When we take drug, which is very efficient, and there are about 50 very efficient anti-cancer drugs, which there is no way to deliver to body because they are not soluble in water. Then we crush it to tiny particles, about 100 nanometers.
So then it's soluble?
No.
Still not
and
yet.
And then we coat them with polymer, which are soluble, and they make this particle dispersible in water, soluble in water. And this particle about 100 nanometers. And just to remind you that 100 nanometers at 0.1 micrometer, 10 times less than micrometer. And our hair cross-section about 50 micrometers. So it's about 500 times smaller than cross-section of hair. Then this otherwise insoluble anti-cancer drug become insoluble, and we can inject them into the body.
So you use your nanoscience concepts to, number one, make a cancer drug more applicable in the body.
Not more.
Well, even applicable, where it wouldn't have been applicable in the first place. And then also, you've applied techniques to these drugs where you can control the time of release. So,
yes.
In other words, I don't just put that cancer drug
but
in
it's
today.
It's released not 2-3 hours, right, but let's say 30, 50 hours.
So it can diffuse over time.
Other application, we had about $500,000 contract with Baxter Corporation on nozzle delivery of insulin, where we created insulin encapsulated with our method in small capsule, and it you can spray it at nose. So this formulation was actually commercialized, and you can buy this product called Promax, product insulin formulation for nozzle spray.
So your work and nanoscience in general has been really impactful in trying to improve the way we deliver drugs in the body.
Yes.
We're not changing the drug.
So we are not
changing the way that they interact in the body.
Yes, we are not biochemists who discover drugs. We are different. We take already known drug and formulate it for more efficient delivery to the body.
So let's back up a little bit or shift gears. So you grew up in Slavgorod, Russia.
Yes.
In Siberia, in the Soviet Union. You were born in a Siberian Soviet labor camp. And at that time, your father, for lack of a better term, was a poop mover in the camp. He moved human waste from one place to place. Now, how, just help me understand, how do you go from being the son of a poop mover in a Siberian labor camp to Moscow University and then eventually somehow to the Max Planck Institute in Germany?
No, you know that Russian history is tragical as well as American. We had big civil war. And in this civil war, my family was very rich and very noble, and they lost war. They lost war and returned their estate was in Lithuania, which was not included in Russia. In 1941, before Second World War, Soviet Russia occupied Lithuania with pact with Hitler, and immediately all Russians was arrested. Men were shot very soon, and all family was sent to Siberia. I wasn't born there. My father was 13 years old. His mother and other, they went to Siberia, and it was very difficult time. First 3 years till 45, they were living in camp. But then it was not camp, it was like exile. So my father has to sign in local KGB office every day that he's here, and my grandmom. So it was, but I was born there. It was restricted. We were not allowed to go outside Slavgorod. It was a small city in Siberia. But my remembers are the best because I was born there. When you're born somewhere, you like this place. Yeah. First of all, very, very good climate. Much good better climate than in Moscow.
Not what people think of Siberia.
Summer, we boys used only shorts. No shoes, nothing. Because summer from 1st June till end August, about 90, 100 Fahrenheit. Then very short fall, snow in October and snow till April. And winter is very cold.
Maybe it's kind of in southern Siberia.
Fahrenheit, maybe minus 20, minus 30. But very sunny, very bright, everything's shining. No rain.
I wonder if your dad remembers it the same way.
No, of course they. And this give me kind of potential. And people were very free. It's paradox. It was Siberia.
Right.
100 population are in exile.
Yeah.
They're all.
Everyone's exiled.
Everyone exiled. So people were free, were talking whatever. So it was not so bad place. So it was like a compressed spring during this suppression of freedom. And when Stalin was dead, and in 1956 it was announced freedom, it was huge enthusiasm among people. People think, and till 1956, it wasn't allowed for exiled people to learn anything. It wasn't allowed to go to school. And then it was like spring opened, and everyone started to work hard. My father got high education, university. No, I was baby. I didn't remember it. But so it was huge suppression, but I was lucky to be born in the moment when this suppression was released.
And he found his way back to the academy and did his PhD in the
humanities. The only problem is that when he first entered to university, he was not allowed to study any engineering or science matter. Mm. So it's only what he was allowed to study Russian or pedagogy. He became a professor of Russian language.
But you had the opportunity to study science.
Yes, and still, when I was at school, then we moved from Siberia first to Ural and then to Moscow. When my father grows and I was grows.
And you started with physics, right? Physics.
Yes, it was beginning. I was in high school in mid-60s. It was huge enthusiasm about science in Russia and America too. And it was the heroes were scientists, physicists.
You wanted to be a hero.
No, but it was like when I was a kid, I heard many of these stories about our family, about
wanted to emulate
its, let's say, glory. And it was the only way to rebound family glory.
Right.
I never was said directly, became proud of our family. No, but there were so many stories about famous history of our. For example, one of my grandfather was author of Russian hymn. How
The Russian, like the national hymn?
Yes. Mm. Not, of course, Soviet Union.
Right.
This story was maybe under my brain cover, and then they grew.
So you make your way to Moscow with the family, you go to Germany, go to Japan.
First, I was admitted to number one Moscow State University.
Right.
It's approximately like in the U.S. to be admitted to Harvard.
You get to Germany, you get to Japan, you create this connection with the U.S. Naval Research Lab. Your son goes to Princeton. Your wife makes you find a way to get closer to him. Long story short, you eventually became a U.S. citizen. And I have heard you say that you think this country is a great place for people who work hard to be successful. So why did you become a U.S. citizen, and what does that mean to you?
No, I think I could compare socialist Russia. I could compare German system, Japan system, where I lived years. And I could compare U.S. And I think even we all have something to criticize. On my opinion, it's the most fair for usual hardworking people system in the world. Of course, we have some minuses, but still it allows for good professional working hard to develop your professionalism and life to very good level. So it, let's say American style of life, American business relation corresponds very well to my character. So I think America is for strong people. I often was discussing this with my German friends, which thinks that German system better. And then they told it's more humanistic. Yes, it's maybe more humanistic for people who are not work hard, but it's less fair to hardworking people. And America rewards, first of all, hardworking people, which I like and which I appreciate.
And you reward the hardworking students in your lab, right?
Different. Problem is to find proper place for everyone. There are different people. Maybe I graduated about 25 PhD students with a degree in engineering. Maybe 5-6 from them were brilliant. 5-6 were weak, and about 10 medium. Problem is,
we won't name any names, but
average you have
everyone can speculate that they were one of the brilliant ones.
3, 4, 5 students. So you have to use to find proper place for everyone, so that leaders could help other. It's like group team. Mm-hmm. So you have to find proper place for every team.
Yeah, that's a critical part of a research scientist's life that people don't think a lot of is the work involved in recruiting and organizing and managing a team of undergraduate and mostly graduate students or postdoc researchers under your wing, bringing them along in their career, getting the work done that you need to get done, finding the right things for them to do based on their different skill sets, capacity, and interests, and doing that year after year over time.
Yes, to make them interested to produce things. And graduate school, it's not just learning. It is really produce something needed for people, which will give you in return, publication, citation, and first of all, grants and contracts. And we had many industrial contracts and grants from National Science Foundation and other foundations.
So nanotech has this, you know, sort of world of promise associated with it and potential. And a lot of that's already being realized. But for years, there's also been a lot of concerns that people have, you know, what these nanoscale organisms or machines might be harmful to humans or to the environment, maybe toxic nanoparticles. Should we be worried about nanotechnology?
No, first of all, my definition of nanotechnology. It's nothing magic in nanotechnology. You know that in the 70s, it was microtechnology, like micromanufacturing technology in America, when every machine, every device was built with precision at least 1 micrometer. So it means engineers were trained to work with such precision, students were trained to work with such precision, all machines were produced to work with such precision. Nanotechnology is just decreasing the scale of precision of industry 10 times better. So 100 nanometer, it's 0.1 micrometer. So nanotechnology in broad sense means that all our industry has to work with precision 10 times better. We have to produce machines which are working with such precision. We have to train students to work 10 times better than micrometer. And then luckily, when we scale down precision, actually, improve precision. Right. We found that details which we can make are really in dimension of fraction of cells, cells organelles, or virus. So ideal nanomachine, not always useful. So many viruses are useful, bacteriophages, are nanomachine. For example, this flu virus is 100 nanometer sphere. So ideal nanomachine is virus. Itself assembles itself.
If we can make it do what we want it to.
Many viruses very useful. There are very efficient anti-cancer treatment with special viruses. Special class of viruses called bacteriophages, considered that they can replace antibiotics to treat, and they, by the way, were discovered in America, to treat different diseases to kill bacteria. Because bacteria is about 100 times larger than virus. And virus may be good bullet to kill bacteria. Mm-hmm. So there are unpleasant viruses like now coronavirus. But we can make viruses, our friends, working for us. And many things are done in this direction.
Our ability to manipulate and control things at the nanoscale is what will determine how well we can control a virus as a nanomachine.
Absolutely. Yes, there are concerns that nanoparticles may be harmful for environment, but it's still at very, very early stage. Still, we don't produce much nanoparticles. Still, if you try to buy nanoparticle, you can buy grams. It's still not essential danger.
But you've been building up work, working specifically with a nanomaterial that is biocompatible or biodegradable. It's eco-friendly, let's call it.
And this, in career of any person, there are more than one engine. One my engine is what we invented in Germany, layer by layer self-assembly. And second engine, which I invented at Louisiana Tech 20 years ago, I'm a long time already here, it's clay nanotubes.
Clay nanotubes.
It's big advantage that these are natural nanotubes. So clay exists. Kaolin is one. Kaolin is one of the most common clay which you see as a dirted street. And in some places, this kaolin rolls in the tubes. And these tubes, tiny, tiny, they're nanotubes. And they can be excavated in million stones. And they're natural. So no, they're not harmful. For example, carbon nanotube may be harmful.
One of the nanomaterials that we use or devices is a carbon nanotube.
Yes.
And those have some toxic qualities to them. And you have begun working with a naturally occurring nanotube, clay halocyte.
And I'm very jealous to carbon nanotube. Well, first of all, they were almost, it was Nobel Prize. But till now, there is no even one major application of carbon nanotube. There are small applications. And it's estimated that over $40 billion spent for development of carbon nanotube. Mm-hmm. So there is something to be jealous. So our clay nanotube, at least 1,000 times cheaper, available in million tons, and it's natural product. The only disadvantage of our nanotube is that they are not conductive. So they cannot use in electronics. But they can be used, for example, for drug encapsulation, for biotissue, for many, for water
many things that carbon nanotubes can't be used for.
Besides, in any activity, it's important to be leader. So Louisiana Tech and team working with me are the world leader in clay nanotube, in this so-called halocyte clay nanotube. And it gives us many advantages. For example, we more or less control this area of research. So people who want to research often approach us asking something like recently, you will be surprised, L'Oreal Cosmetic Corporation and other company often approach us trying to develop technology on clay nanotubes.
So you have clearly demonstrated in your career and your work and helped enable the broad, immense range of possibilities and applications for nanoscience and nanotechnology to impact society and human activity. So Thank you for all that work. Thank you for the time. Thank you for being here this morning. It's been great to have you, Dr. Yuri Levov from Louisiana Tech University. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Beyond 1894. If you liked what you heard, please rate and review us. It will help others find our podcast. If you would like to learn more about today's guest or find details about the episode, check out our show notes. To find our podcast webpage, go to 1894.lawtech.edu/beyond. If you have suggestions for future episodes, email us at 1894@lawtech.edu. We would love your input, so tell us what you want to hear. Beyond 1894 is produced by the Office of University Communications, with help from the Wagner Center and the School of Music at Louisiana Tech University. Dave Norris is the executive producer, I, Amy Bell, am the producer and the chief editor, and the music featured was arranged by Kalis Ash.